Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and I have my good buddy Mike with me. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Joyce. It's a beautiful day out there. I hope everybody's doing well.
Thank you. I hope so, too. And it's very cold in Boston right now, but we're surviving. And but it is a beautiful, sunshiny day. So we're going to talk today about taking care of the community. And when I was preparing for this show, several people said to me, how does that fit on the powerful patient? And it's like, what occurred to Mike and me is we deal mostly with people on the personal level. And when someone gets a terrible diagnosis, a shocking diagnosis, like you have cancer, all of a sudden we like retreat into ourselves and we have to take care of our own selves. And sometimes we don't realize just how much this impacts not only us personally, but the spouse, the children, the family, the community, all of our friends. And somebody also needs to take care of the greater community. And that could be some school psychologist. It could be a minister or a rabbi. And so we're privileged to have with us today two experts in this. And they didn't ask for it, but they became experts on the job. First of all, Bonnie Vogelai, who's from Newtown, Connecticut. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Joyce. Hi.
Hi. So Bonnie is a PsyD. She's a school psychologist, and she works with the children from Sandy Hook Elementary School and their families and their whole community. And joining us later is going to be Rabbi William Hamilton, who is from Congregation Kehillat Israel in Boston, and he's one of the people who was called to Logan Airport on 9/11. So, you know, they've really been dealing with enormous traumas, traumas that have had reverberations around the country and around the world. And I thought we could take a look at...
Just to clarify that one little piece, I don't actually work at Sandy Hook Elementary School. I work as a school psychologist in a neighboring district, but I live in Newtown, and my role as part of taking care of those kids has not been my professional role, but it has been on a personal level, in that they're my friends and my congregation members and my family, that these are, that as a community we're taking care of each other. But I don't actually work as a school psychologist in that school.
Great. So I thought maybe we could take a look with Bonnie at some of the things that have been going on in her community that she's found particularly helpful, and the lessons that we can learn from that about how we can deal, even on a personal level, with not only looking at ourselves, but also realizing the reverberations that there are around us. So Bonnie, tell us a little bit about how Newtown is recovering from this terrible shock.
Sure. I will tell you, it is the most difficult thing that I have ever kind of witnessed on a personal level. And this is after, you know, witnessing some medical crises in my own family members and some really difficult things. To watch our entire community go through this level of grief together, this has been hard. This has been really, really hard. One of the messages that has continued to come out of this is that Newtown will be redefining how this has come to define us, that we will not be defined by the horrific events that occurred, but that we will be defined by how we came together as a community to take care of each other and to spread this message on to the rest of the world of love, of peace, of light, and that that we cannot let it just end at the horrific events that happened on that day. We all feel very committed to the fact that for these children and these families to have made this sacrifice, that there must be an explosion of good and love that reverberates around the world a million times over to to help put anybody to this place where we feel like we can get through this. One of the biggest things that I have noticed happening around town is that there has been this immediate sense of community that, although I've lived in this town now for 13 years, and I have felt very connected to this community even prior to this happening, through the kids' school and activities and the synagogue and, you know, many different religious organizations in town, people do feel, already felt very connected to this community to begin with. But since this tragedy has happened, there has been such an increased sense of community and pride in our town that really has made a big difference. I heard somebody say that we no longer in Newtown shake hands. Nobody shakes hands. We just hug. You know, there is this increased sense of belonging and caring for each other, being together, and that is what has helped me on a personal level. When I think of, you know, in my darkest moments, what has helped, it's those times when I have come together with my community members. In the early days, after this happened, one of the first community events I attended was a holiday party for my third grader. Now, my third grader does not go to Sandy Hook Elementary School, but he does go to one of the other elementary schools in town. So he was at school in the days after this happened, and there was just a small party in his classroom where it was the first time that we as parents had gathered with and to see other students in the room. And to see the children drinking their hot cocoa with their marshmallows and having their snacks and making their crafts, and then to be with parents. And, you know, it's such a surreal kind of moment where no words needed to be said. Really, all that was needed was, you know, a look in the eye, a hand on the shoulder, a hug around the neck, and, you know, oftentimes a tear down the cheek. And it really was one of those moments where you just needed to be with people. You did not need to have any great conversation or magical words of wisdom. But that, for me, was what really first started the healing process. It's been quite an up and down journey, though. I know as a school psychologist, I knew that this would not be a straight line. I knew this would not be a linear journey. I knew there would be ups and downs. What has surprised me, though, is how often my steps backwards are really kind of ripping me all the way back to the beginning. You know, that has been the hard part in this, is really feeling like it's not two steps forward, one step back. It's two steps forward, two steps back. It's there's so many complicated levels to this to sort through.
Tell us more about that. Tell us a little bit more about that.
You know, I keep trying to describe it as our brains try so hard to make sense of what's happening in our lives. And our brains are trying so hard to take what happened and put it in a box and say, this makes sense because of this X, Y, and Z. But it is just something that can't fit in any box, because no matter what they find as part of when they finish writing up the police report, and no matter what they can say to us about whatever mental health diagnoses this perpetrator may or may not have had, that this will never fit in a box. And so I think we try so hard to make sense of something that is not ever going to be able to be made sense of. And we come through and it's the type of thing, too, where there's so many different levels. So there's your own personal level at which you're experiencing this and trying to make sense of it and trying to understand it, and that you're also, you know, going through your own levels of grief and anger and sadness and questioning. And then every once in a while, or even, you know, not every once in a while, but every day, every minute of every day, you come into contact with a friend, you hear of another story, you hear about another child, you hear about a sibling, you hear about a neighbor. That one of the things, and I'm not sure being right in the middle of this, I don't have a sense of what this would look like if I was outside of Newtown, but it's still, 5 weeks out, almost 6 weeks out, it is something we are faced with from the moment we wake up in the morning until the moment we go to bed. Even though I work in the next town over, I have coworkers who live in Newtown, it's just, you open up the newspaper to read with your morning cereal, and it's filled with condolence messages from around the world, which is amazing. But it's the kind of thing where you're constantly being reminded of other people's journeys through the same exact process. And I think that's a part of the piece for me, getting back to this business about two steps forward and two steps back, is that you think you've made some progress on your own motions through this, and then all of a sudden you step into somebody else's shoes and boom, you're right back at the beginning of
right.
the process again, looking at it from a perspective you've never even considered before, looking at it from, you know, or learning new information that we hadn't known about before. There's still things that are unfolding. And one of the things
right.
that I've tried really hard to do is walk that very fine line between learning information, getting news and knowledge, but holding back too, because I have learned for myself personally that I need to protect myself from too many explicit descriptions of what happened, whether it's through the media, or I have found Facebook to be a real plus and minus type thing where I get a lot of information
mm-hmm.
and support
mm-hmm.
and connections through Facebook, but there are times where I have had to just shut the computer and walk away because it's just too much.
I hear you.
So.
Yeah, sometimes when there's a loss like that, you'll be going through your day and you'll say, oh, this is so amusing, I need to share it with my friend, and then all of a sudden it hits you, your friend isn't there to call. And, you know, so just those, as you say, all of a sudden you go, oh, right, I forgot, there's that tragedy. And I thought it was very moving when you described going to the birthday party. It's just the magic of seeing normalcy and realizing what a miracle that is.
Yes, yes. You know, that is such a great way to describe it, in that, you know, without this tragedy having occurred, we still would have been at that same holiday party, but without the appreciation for what a miracle that is, the connections that we have in our lives truly are a miracle. And my connections with my friends have never been more important. I can't tell you how many times I'll send a quick text or an email, just check in, just saying hello, that
mm-hmm.
we have really made an effort, and maybe effort's not the right word, because I don't mean to imply that it's been hard. You know, it's almost like I'm not sure I could get through my day without some quick check-in emails from people that I know or people that I'm close to. It has, and this is where technology has helped a lot, because, you know, you could be sitting at the grocery store or in a, you know, in a slow moment at work, and you pop open your smartphone and there's a comforting few words from a friend that means, okay, I can keep going. I can do this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned before that you didn't know how it felt from outside the community, and I think, well, let's back up. We start on the day of, there's all the commotion that goes on around getting people to the hospital and dealing with the immediacy of it all, and you don't even get the whole picture until another couple of days. And then there's all these reverberations. And when one person dies, it's like throwing a pebble in the lake. But when you have 26 people who died and 26 pebbles going into the lake, there are all these circles and all these reverberations going on within each of those individual families, all the people who knew them, who were around them, who went to school with them, who went to work with them. And then it reaches out beyond, as you say, beyond your community. I live in Boston, which is 2 hours away. And here, the feeling is, oh, my God, if it could happen there, it could happen here. Do I dare send my children to school? You know, it's every parent's worst nightmare is suddenly right there.
Yes, and I think that's a big piece about where people have connected with this so strongly, is that, you know, as scary as it sounds, if it can happen at Sandy Hook Elementary in our little country town of Newtown, Connecticut, it really truly can happen anywhere. And it, you know, it just reminds us of the unpredictability of our lives,
right.
which is, you know, scary for us all to think about.
Right. I mean, we work with people who make risk-benefit decisions about healthcare all the time. And I was talking to somebody the other day, and I said, look, there are risks in life. There's risks to crossing the street. So, you know, you're not going to have a no-risk scenario, but we have to get our risks down to where we feel we can manage them. And all of a sudden, this throws us way out of balance. And, Mike, you're in North Carolina. Tell us what reverberations you see in your own community.
Well, it's something that you know, it is present with most of the people here that is going on and things of that nature. We recently had a murder suicide that occurred here in the county just a few weeks ago, and from outward appearances, the entire community thought that these two people were madly in love with each other. And it turned out that the spouse killed the person and then went out and committed suicide. And you know, the impact of that is, I think it's kind of like the situation there. And I'm not minimizing or comparing that, but most of us are not really connected with the community like we used to be. We're not connected with our neighbors the way we used to be. And the person right down the street from us may be going through a tremendous crisis where they're almost at that point of desperation and frustration that they're going to go postal if something doesn't intervene. And we don't recognize it because we're too caught up in our own little worlds. And I think Bonnie said something that is so very profound about our brains are trying to put it in a box and it will not fit. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about, you know, one of the favorite television episodes that are on now is people going into a house, you know, and they've got all kinds of junk and debris and they're cluttered up and everything, and you see them trying to clean out a person's junk.
Yes.
And we get that way. Our lives are filled up with clutter, and we get to the point that we just cannot compartmentalize things, and our neighbors don't know about it until we've done something desperate.
Right.
Mm. Yeah, and we don't have front porches, and we do have air conditioning, and we do have television sets that are keeping us indoors and not out playing ball. So we're not interacting in the way that we used to either.
That you bring up a good point, you know, as you're saying these things, I'm thinking about my own community connections, and for the most part, they are with people that I already had community connections with through the school, my children's activities, and through my religious organization, through the synagogue. So I have worried about people in town who maybe either don't have children in the district or are not affiliated with one of our religious organizations. And, you know, I did recently learn about a family who was pretty new to town through a mutual friend, and I made sure to reach out to them, and, you know, we have some tentative plans to meet for dinner. But it's so hard to know who needs that arm, that hand reached out to them to say hello. I do know that there is this increased connection, and you know, I was at a doctor's appointment a few towns over a few weeks after this happened, and found out that the receptionist I was talking with was from Newtown, and there was this instant bond between us as we talked about the events and where we live and the pride in our town. But Joyce, the hard part is how to make those connections. It's outside of the paths that you go about on a daily basis. We don't see our neighbors outside. We don't necessarily live in a world where you just know people that live right nearby, and that's a challenge. And it's something that I think, you know, as a greater society, wouldn't that be nice if we could get back somewhat to those days where we had more visible interactions with each other.
Right, before there was much television, there were people playing piano in the evenings or cards or, you know, doing other kinds of social interaction things to fill up that time, that relaxation time, rather than just sitting in front of a box and vegging out.
Right.
So, and I think that in a certain sense, the social media has tried to fill that space, to provide some connections for us in a different way.
And
sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't.
Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I think
right.
I was going to say that same thing, that in some ways social media has connected us more to other people because, you know, you can join a group on Facebook, say, where, you know, people with a certain similarity can all join that group and get to know each other, but then you're getting to know each other through words you type on the screen, and, you know, you're lacking that connection, and I think that we all are longing for that connection, and that is what has helped so much in this situation. So it's not an easy answer to that one.
Right. There are support groups for various things, thousands of things on the Internet. You can find a group for just about everything. And in my VHL community, there's a young woman out in Indiana who's been feeling completely alone. And so we're encouraging her to find other folks from Indiana who have VHL. So, and that's, it's a rare disease. But through the Internet, one can find a group of fellow travelers for whatever the topic is. And people who've lost children is a biggie. There's a huge gap that appears in your life, and dealing with that and knowing how to respond to that is really hard. What kinds of things have you found that are helping parents to deal with that, a heart-rending loss?
Well, for the parents of those 20 children, I have not had direct contact with those parents. This is, that is a group of people that clearly need very specialized kind of grief and trauma counseling. I can't speak to any of them on a personal level as far as what they have been doing. But I can speak more towards just the greater community as far as when these topics come up. I do have many friends in town who go to that school and whose children go to that school. And beyond the parents of those 20 kids, I'm also really concerned for the children who were in the building that day and the teachers who were in the building that day and who witnessed these events firsthand. And one of the things that I have been trying to help sort through and help my friends sort through is the types of counseling that are being offered. And we need to be really careful because when somebody goes through this level of trauma, really, they need more than just a supportive counseling therapy type setting where you're just going to kind of retell your story and, have a good listener on the other end, that really this needs to be a specialized kind of counseling where you kind of change the ending, come to resolution, process the emotions, and there are a few different types of therapy for that. So that's been part of my role in working with my friends from Sandy Hook, is trying to see to help where I can guide that where necessary. I know that there have been some support groups that have been going on. Some people are finding them helpful. Some people are not. And I think that is so typical of any of these types of therapy, is that we're all such individuals, and there's not ever going to be one type of therapy that is going to work for every person. I work at a high school, and I kind of describe it or compare it to, somebody might have Mrs. Jones for English and say, this is the best teacher I've ever had, and then somebody else might have Mrs. Jones and say, I don't get along with her at all. I can't stand her
class.
Because it comes down to that personality issue, and no two people are going to have the same experience. So, the same holds true here, but whatever it is that helps somebody through this, whatever type of therapy that is, I've been working hard to make sure people are getting what they need. And there's a very wide range of those needs. Some of us who are, not directly connected to any of the children who were lost or faculty who were lost, we are connected through our community members who are connected and just through the greater sense of tragedy that has happened. But then there's a continuum from that all the way down to, children who were in that classroom and teachers who witnessed this. And those people need some very specialized support. And, again, that's a little beyond my realm of, I don't have firsthand knowledge of what most of those people are receiving, but it's a continuum. It's a continuum of need, and the other thing we keep talking about as a town is that this is a very long road, a very, very, very long road. And whereas, the news trucks came in and inundated us for a few weeks, and we're ready to move on to the next, we recognize that here we are 6 weeks out, still at the beginning of this road, still kind of coming through the numbness, still not quite letting this fully sink in, recognizing that we have a really long way to go. And honestly, I mean, from the way I look at it, these children are first graders. This is something that our town is going to be feeling straight on through as this class moves on up through the ranks and heads toward their, senior year of high school. Something that is, you know, it's here. It's the new normal, we have been saying. We need to learn how to live with this and make it the new normal. And it's that process of how do you go about making this the new normal is something that takes a long time to figure out. I would imagine it's, you know, similar to, like you said, dealing with a scary medical diagnosis, that you're going to get to a point where that's the new normal. But the process of going through that is a long one and a hard one.
That's right. And that whole grieving process, it's been described as a number of steps, but it's not always a linear progression. It doesn't always happen in that sequence. And people will be on different timelines about it, so that I can imagine that you've got some people who are, you know, ready to get on with it, and other people who are, like, still dazed, and other people who are angry, looking for somebody to blame. And so having people on all those different steps all at the same time must be particularly hard to deal with, too. I can imagine that in a small community like yours, that there would be a limited number of personnel with your level of skill, and there must be a certain all-hands-on-deck kind of thing going on, too.
Well, but what has happened is there have been a lot of people coming in from the outside to help.
Uh-huh.
And honestly, like in the early days when this first happened, I was not even in a position to be able to be a member of a crisis team. My mom had said something to me, like, kind of implying, because she knew I was, of course, just so sad and depressed and in those first few days, and my mom called and said, how about if I tried to join a crisis team to help other people, and wouldn't that make me feel better? And I said to her something along the lines of, I didn't think I could both be on the crisis team and needing the services of the crisis team at the same time. I have been very thankful for the support that has come in from really worldwide. In fact, early on, there was a parent support meeting at my son's elementary school where it was facilitated by federal emergency response psychologists, which seeing, you know, kind of hearing those words and realizing, wait a second, the federal government has come here to help us. You know, there was this very sense of this disorientation early on that just seeing the trucks in town, and I mean, it was disorienting enough to hear that what happened had happened, that all these children had been killed and teachers had been killed. Like, that in itself was disorienting enough. But then when you go as a parent to talk with some other parents and get some support around it, and you find out the people who are running your group are from the federal disaster response team, that, you know, that shakes you up a little bit. And then for me, it was also so disorienting, too. The people who reached out to me, phone calls from people I hadn't heard from in a long time, or cards and letters in the mail, all things that were very helpful and wonderful and kind, but at the same time, you know, I went back and read through some of the emails I had received and tried to remember some of the phone calls, and I realized I was not even fully in my body for those moments, because I said, oh, yeah, that person called me. This one sent me that email. I had forgotten about that. And, you know, it made me realize, and I think that's a defense mechanism where you do go numb and you do step outside yourself, because to have to experience it full blast like that is just really more than we can handle in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Mike and I both experienced it. When you're in the hot seat and you're getting bad news from the doctor, there's a certain point when your brain just says, okay, buddy, you've had enough, and it just kind of shuts down. And, I mean, you're still awake, you're still aware, you're still sitting there looking at the doctor and nodding your head up and down, but you're just not getting it, because the brain has just gone out to lunch, thank you.
Yes, That's exactly it. That's a perfect way to describe it. You can only take so much, and you know, and then for it to be just so disorienting, and you know, you see signs all over your town, and every once in a while, when you come to a place where you may have forgotten about it for a minute, and then the hard part is that so many things that made it disorienting were things that people were doing out of very wonderful and kind and loving places in their hearts. But then all of a sudden you'd, you know, see another reminder or hear from somebody or, you know, people calling with concern. And I imagine that's a similar parallel that people must face going through a medical diagnosis such as that, where, like, people want to call, people want to reach out to you. But, you know, I could imagine you get to the point where you say, oh, I'm just going to put my feet up and watch the football game on TV. And then, you know, another phone call comes in and another person wants to talk to you about it. And
right. I have a friend who went through lung cancer, and one of the recommendations that she had when she was going into treatment was make a voicemail message on your phone to say, thank you very much for your concern. I'm doing well. I'm in therapy, and I really appreciate your call. Goodbye.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Uh-huh. Yes.
But then she could screen calls and didn't have to pick up everyone and, you know, decide who she was up to talking to today. Which I thought was very smart.
And very, it's smart and very self-protective. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
okay to be able to turn down an offer of assistance if that's not what you need in that moment. And
right.
we've had to do that as a community as well. I mean, we were talking about the stuffed animals before, and I can't believe the kindness and the generosity, but it got to a point where Newtown had to donate some of these stuffed animals to, like, the Connecticut Children's Medical Center and the hospitals because we
mm-hmm.
were just drowning in stuffed animals. And another thing that has happened is we have received over 150,000 cards and letters and pictures, and they've all been put on display at our town hall, at our municipal center, and people have been called in to volunteer to sort through that mail and, you know, to accept the numerous donations, which have been so kind and so much appreciated. But I think that that's actually helped our community, too, to have this sense of purpose, this group of people who have come together to volunteer to sort through all that mail and pull the checks for the donations and we had somebody donate a warehouse space and office space. It's given this large core group of people another purpose and another thing to do and another way to take action and feel like they're picking up the pieces of their own
That's
life
right.
and the community.
That's right. And sometimes people say, oh, well, my friends have said, what can I do to help? But I don't want to impose on them. I don't want to be a problem to them. And I think what they sometimes don't realize is that their friends need to be able to help them. And if they just said, you know, if you could make me dinner for two on Friday night and just drop it off, that would be fantastic. And they don't realize what a gift that is to their friend.
I can say from a personal level that I know how hard that can be to accept the help. I know I personally am somebody who, for whatever reason in my own life, feels strongly that I want to be able to take care of myself and my family. My husband and I are in this together, and we're going to do it. And but you're right. It's a hard lesson for many of us to accept that other people, myself included, I feel great when I can help somebody. And what a nice
right.
gift that is to be able to give to somebody and say, please, please help me. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And, you know, that somebody can do that for you and to accept that offer of help.
Right. And we talked before we went on the air about how we resolve this, how we create now this is the new normal, and we have to integrate this into our lives. And we all need to grieve, absolutely, but we can't get stuck in our grief. We have to get through the grief, and we have to get to a point where we can take that energy and turn it into something else that's actually going to enhance our lives and not just stick us in the mud. So how do we take that energy and turn it into positive purpose? What have you seen happening around you?
Well, that is the action piece. That's taking the action. And that is things such as whether it's jumping in to volunteer with these groups, or a lot of times it's that's these connections with these groups. For example, my synagogue hosted an interfaith service just this past weekend, sort of along the lines of the initial interfaith service that was held when the president spoke and how motivating and inspiring that was. And my rabbi wanted to sort of capture that spirit again. So we hosted at our synagogue, and all these different faiths came together, and just each clergy took a turn to sort of speak to us, and we sang songs and then gathered afterwards for some food and fellowship. And it's that piece of it that I think is helping us to turn this into action. It's renewing that message that we are not going to let us Newtown be defined by what happened, that we're going to be defined by how we reacted. And actually, one of the clergy who was there, the reverend of the Newtown Congregational Church, Matt Krebin is his name, spoke about how this is now, whether we like it or not, this is our calling, and that this is what we have to do. And that really touched me, this piece about this is an uninvited calling. Nobody wanted this to happen. We were not looking for this, but it's been given to us, and so now this is what we have to do. And it's one of the reasons I was so grateful to you, Joyce, for the opportunity to speak with you both today, to help anywhere that we as a community, anywhere we can help take another step towards putting that message out there. You know, and when people say, what can I do? What can I do to help? I say, be this difference in the world. Go be kind to somebody. Go say something nice to somebody. Go, you know, we do tend to live in a world full of lots of judgments. You know, it's why we like shows like America's Funniest Home Videos so much. It's why we laugh at that show. We do. We live in a world filled with judgments. And that's where I want to say, you know, go, you know, help somebody up who fell down, or go surprise somebody with something nice. And these random acts of kindness, I just love that whole concept and how inspiring that is when somebody does something nice for you, unexpected like that, for you to then say, this was amazing. What an incredible surprise. I'm going to pass this forward onto somebody else and do something nice. And that's that piece of turning this sadness and feeling stuck and moving on to how are we going to get to the new normal by doing these kinds of things and by taking whatever steps we can. Mm-hmm. And recognizing that you're going to step backwards sometimes, and you never know what it's going to be. For me, the other day, it was driving down the road and seeing the sign on the highway that said Exit 10, Newtown, Sandy Hook, and I just burst out into tears. Another time, it was when my son's bus came up, and I saw the yellow lights blink and then the red, and I watched as he stepped off the bus, and I felt so overwhelmed with gratitude in that moment that my son was okay, and here is his bus bringing him home from school, delivering him to my hands at the end of the driveway. And, you know, I just get overwhelmed in these moments. But I should bring up that piece about the gratitude, too. This, for me, on a personal level, is something that does get me through every day. Especially, I mentioned that, you know, years ago, my husband actually had a brain tumor removed. And that was, prior to this happening, that was the most scariest thing that we had ever been through. And what I have come away from that experience that has carried me through this experience is this place of gratitude and the role that gratitude plays in my life. That in my darkest moments, I just look around and I say, I have these amazing children, this incredible husband. I just feel like I couldn't possibly ask for more in my life. And that has been a huge piece for me on a personal level as well, as what has gotten me through this.
That's right. Those experiences almost shift your perspective on the universe. You know, it's like, oh, I'm looking at things completely differently than I did a month ago, you know.
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly it. I just, you know, that those things that make you say, you know what, this is not a problem. you know, when you get, and I don't ever for a second mean to sound like I don't get, you know, I get stressed out about the little things. I do sweat the small stuff, but then I need the reminders to not do it. You know, I'll get stressed
right.
out about the lunch boxes aren't packed and the house is a mess because it is. And, you know, with my small children and full-time job, it's a lot to juggle. And it does get to me, and I do get stressed out. But when that happens, that's when sometimes I'll remind myself, sometimes it takes my husband to remind me, or sometimes it's the kids who just, you know, you just stop and say, this is not a problem. This messy house is not a problem. This forgotten lunchbox is not a problem. You know, it's the bigger things that are the problems and where really our energy
right.
needs to be directed.
Mike, you want to add something to that? You deal with people with this kind of challenges all the time.
Yes, and I think it, you know, it's very profound what you said about the things that mattered most to you right at those moments just recently. Was it wasn't a TV set, it wasn't a boat, it wasn't the house, it wasn't a car, it was your husband, it was
yeah.
your child.
Yeah.
And those are things, you know, that we need to be able to grasp. It's not our possessions as much as it is the relationships that we have with other people. And
I couldn't agree more. Absolutely.
You know, I run into that quite a lot as people are approaching the final days of their life, you know, and I had a lady that attended a meeting with me a few days ago, and I had saw her by her husband's bedside in past weeks, and she would try to get him to eat, and he didn't want it, and she would keep on and keep on. And she's also a volunteer at an organization, so she was going through this training with me. And after we returned to her husband's room later that day, she said, you know, I've been telling other people they don't need to try to force their spouse to eat, but I've been doing it myself, and I need to quit that. I need to just savor the moment that we have together. So,
yeah.
Wow.
Yes, very, very profound. You're exactly right. That's all we really, in the end, I once heard somebody say that in the end, all we really have are the people in our lives and the memories we make with them. And the experiences that we have with them, and that the rest of it just kind of gets dragged along behind us for the ride. But it's the people and our connections and our memories.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think Reverend Hamilton has joined us. Reverend Hamilton, are you there?
I am.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us. Yeah.
You're welcome. I'm sorry I'm so late.
Oh, that's okay. So we have Bonnie Vogeli, who's a school psychologist from Newtown, Connecticut. We've been talking with her about the response of Newtown to their tragedy, and I know that you were one of the people called to Logan Airport on the day that the planes went down on 9/11. And what we were talking about is taking care of the community. That how do we deal with things on such a large scale? And we've talked about the personal side of this kind of a loss, and then you multiply that by 26 or by 260 or whatever it was on 9/11, and how does one even begin to help a community recover from this kind of a tragedy? What have you found that was so helpful?
Well, I have to say that whether it's on a large scale or a medium scale, what I found certainly on 9/11 was that it was person to person. It was profoundly intimate. My perhaps best illustration of that was in grief counseling at Logan Airport. In within hours of the realization of what had taken place, probably around 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon that day on September 11, 2001, I was in a room with a father and his daughters, and they had just lost their wife and mother, and someone knocked on the door and said, the president, leader of the nation, and on a day like that, on the largest scale, is stepping up to lead. They said the president is about to address the nation. Would you like to come out and watch the address? And the father and husband, in this case, who had just lost his wife, he said, no, I don't want to come out and watch. He was in his world. He was profoundly impacted on a personal level by the fact that his world had just been completely shattered. He was imagining how he was going to go dress shopping with his daughters, something he'd never done before. He was reaching out to family members, to friends, and to faith. And it seems to me that even on a large scale, on the enormity of an event like 9/11, like September 11, 2001, it still comes down to the network and the web of connections that are very, very deep and intimate and poignant. And that there's no substitute for that, even when one imagines leadership on a national level or perhaps even a multinational level. It really cannot take the place of the profoundly personal and direct human interaction.
Right. So it all starts at the personal level, of course. And then the friends and relations begin to hear about it too, and the nation responds and the world responds. But really it's all the one-on-one interactions that are the most important. Is that what I heard you say?
That's correct. And I also have to say to Bonnie that I think that the extraordinary, I have a close friend who's also a chaplain, as am I, and he was in Newtown, and he was completely awestruck by the extraordinary way in which the community and the people of the Newtown community have made this. What is so remarkable is that the response, the coming together, the glowing humanity, the way in which the community has responded, at least from what I can tell and from what I've heard and from the stories that have been told to me, is becoming much more about what the community is being known for.
Rabbi, thank you so much for saying that. Really, that's our goal. That's our goal, is that we will not be known for the horror that happened. We will be known for how we came through this and how we came together, and hope to be able to, just continue doing this and continue rising from this.
Yeah. Well, it's an extraordinary inspiration, and I think that is really very much in evidence, and not that any other community, and I know you feel this way, should ever have to learn from your example. But it somehow does suggest that the response is to the horror is truly holy.
Right, and none of us can control what may happen to us, whether it's a medical diagnosis or an automobile accident or an earthquake or anything. But all any of us can control is how we respond to things.
That's right. I was going to just add that there really, from my faith tradition, there are two important questions that come up whenever tragic or terrible things happen. The first is, why did this happen? And the second is, what then shall I do? And it seems to me that we have to ask the first question, because it's wrong. What has happened is wrong in every way, and we should cry out against it. But, we come to the second question with the first question left unanswered. And what then shall I do becomes essentially, as you put it, Joyce, our the measure of our response becomes determinative as to whether or not we're going to allow the wrongness of the initial act or cause to define us.
Right, right. Thank you. So, Mike, do you have any other questions that you want to put to our guests while we're together?
Well, I don't know if our rabbi friend heard Bonnie make the comment that that in Newtown, where formerly they would shake hands, they no longer shake hands; they embrace each other, and I think that is drawing them together. And Rabbi, you said, what then shall I do? That is so pressing that we need to be doing that. And a lot of times we don't. We ask why, and then we never try to formulate a plan for action after that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I did not get a chance to hear that from Bonnie. That is very, very touching. And again, it's a tribute to a determination to emphatically make the statement that the perpetrator of the horror is the very last person who deserves to define the essence of the community and the sharing of the holiness and the honor and again the glowing humanity. I love that idea. And that reality of the embrace. Beautiful.
It is. It was our the president of our synagogue during one of the events we had shortly after this happened is the one who had said that we just in Newtown there's no more handshaking. We see people at Starbucks, we see people at the supermarket, and it's a hug and sometimes a tear. And very often you don't even need the words. You just, it's that look in the eye, and it says it all.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I guess I want to say one other thing, that I was very moved by the extraordinary interfaith service that took place in Newtown that many of us witnessed on as it was broadcast. And I think that, Joyce, your question of larger scale, without getting political, I think that our national leader in that setting was asked some profoundly religious and meaningful and spiritually real questions about, that is, President Obama, what are we here for? What is one of our lives? What do we do with our time and our toil? And again, we don't want ever the kind of massacre, the kind of evil to have sway in Newtown or in any community for any people. But again, to be able to be brought to those kinds of questions, to move beyond the handshakes to the hug, to consider our humanity, our purpose, the reason we're here. This is, if nothing else, that's the point of the larger scale dimension, Joyce, is that even those of us who are not in Newtown and don't know people from Newtown, wherever we may be, we ponder, we consider, we pause, we focus and refocus our lives, and if we can do that, then something important and response far and wide can take place as well.
And
right.
For that, we are grateful. We are, for any person who could see what happened in Newtown and say, you know what, I'm going to go hug somebody today. I'm going to spread this kindness that we really strongly feel like for what these families went through, that this explosion of love, of kindness, of peace, that this is what's going to get us through this, to see these things happening. And so, you know, I will thank you on behalf of my community anytime that can happen as a result of this.
Thank you both so much. And so we want to remind everybody that they're listening to a show on powerfulpatient.org. And Bonnie Vogeli and Rabbi William Hamilton, thank you so much for being with us today. Mike, do you have any closing statements that you'd like to add?
Well, it's just like Newtown. They're redefining the situation and the circumstances. And for each one of us as a powerful patient, when adversity comes our way, we need to redefine our situation and not let that adverse moment define our lives. I really appreciate you getting these guests together, Joyce. Rabbi, you and Bonnie have done a wonderful job, and we thank you for it.
Thank you.
I'm very honored to have been included, and again, honored to be here with Bonnie and with Joyce and with you, Mike. Thank you.
And same from here. Thank you for the opportunity, and keep us in your thoughts and prayers. We appreciate that very much.
Thank you so much. And to everybody out there, you know, continue to take whatever adversity has come your way, and we all have our little bit of adversity in everybody's life, but see what you can do to turn that positive. And as Bonnie said, spread the love, and remember that Newtown in particular wants to be defined by their response to this tragedy and not by the tragedy itself. Their ability to bounce back, to recover, to hug one another is what we need to remember about this. So thank you all. I hope everybody will have a good week ahead and be well and be a powerful patient. Thank you so much.